This is Liner Note Leftovers, your weekly musical discovery hosted by 106.1 The GOAT's resident crate digger, Dan Soul. Let's dive in.
All right, my lovelies, it is time once again to go on a virtual crate digging exploration, explore the hallowed halls of rock and roll, and dig through some minutiae and facts that no one should have memorized. Sure, maybe a lot of us can't do math and some of us don't know English good, but when you can spring rock and roll facts on your friends, that's what counts at the end of the day. That's what sets you ahead in this world. This week, we got kind of another interesting pattern here. All of these involve the external things in rock and roll history. Something very weird you'll notice in the Addicted to Love music video by Robert Palmer. The story of Dick Rowe, who you know for the biggest blunder perhaps in history, let alone rock history. But nobody remembers that he redeemed himself this week, but we'll get into that. And also, we're going to talk about how the Eagles taught Rolling Stone.
There's no crying in baseball!
Episode 8, Liner Note Leftovers, starts now. You know, it's interesting. In music communities, Robert Palmer's Addicted to Love, which hit number one on the charts on May 3rd, 1986, has been called the original Robin Thicke's Blurred Lines, which I don't know is entirely fair, considering the Robin Thicke song is a lot more creepy and weird. But all feelings about Robin Thicke aside, there were some odd choices made in the Robert Palmer Addicted to Love music video that kind of could maybe give it that reputation. Because you know what I'm talking about here if you ever saw it on MTV. Robert Palmer in the thick black tie and the big white shirt, and then the five fashion models as his band. And you know what you're picturing in your head. Black dress, fishnets, bold makeup, slick back hair. But what's really weird is those models were never supposed to be in this music video. But there was supposed to be one woman, Chaka Khan. That's right, Queen of Funk, Chaka Khan. She was supposed to be doing it as a duet with Robert Palmer. That's how the song was conceived, but a bunch of logistical garbage with Warner Brothers made that so it wasn't going to be a thing. So instead, Robert Palmer duets it with member of Duran Duran, Andy Taylor, and they decide to do a music video that's sort of inspired by the whole Art Deco movement. Just one slight problem though. Those models, if you watch them, they're all out of time. Nobody knows what they're doing. Nobody's playing chords. The drummer's not even hitting the skins. And that's because none of these models knew how to play instruments. They were there for their look. They weren't there for being able to play. In fact, just to try and make it a little better, Robert Palmer hired up a session musician to show them how to play instruments. And that session musician ended up getting so frustrated that he just left. He just abandoned the filming. And to make matters worse, according to the bassist for the video, a lady by the name of Mac Gilchrist, the girls and director Terrence Donovan decided to share a bottle of wine as they were getting their makeup done, causing her to lose her balance during filming and smack the back of Robert Palmer's head with her guitar. But interestingly enough, all these fiascos aside, it hit MTV and went off like a fire, launched the song to number one on the Hot 100, and has been parodied to no end. It was parodied in Bowling for Soup's 1985, Stardust's Music Sounds Better With You, of course, Weird Al Yankovic's Addicted to Spuds, Shania Twain's Man, I Feel Like a Woman. That video is a flip parody where they use dudes in the place of the women. And those Pepsi commercials, including the early ones starring Britney Spears, they also parodied Robert Palmer's Addicted to Love. And perhaps in the most weird and interesting turn about this, in 1995, Johnny Cash, backed by Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, recorded a version for the album Unchained, but then they thought that was too weird and corny to ever release. Some people did take it seriously though, Tina Turner's version, arguably among the best. But if you ever wonder what those girls are doing nowadays, Patty Kelly, who's the girl on guitar, studied art history, horticulture, and landscape design. Kathy Davies, who was on the drum, was a children's teacher in Thailand. Julia Bellino, also on guitar, she's a makeup artist now. And Matt Gilchrist, still a model, owns a project called The Edible Bus Stop. But today, we kind of remember them as the backing band that couldn't shoot straight.
You can't sleep, you can't eat, there's no doubt.
Yeah.
Good times, bad times, you know I've had my share, is not only a great line from the Led Zeppelin tune of the same name, it also pretty much embodies the 1973 North America tour, which at that time cemented Led Zeppelin as the biggest band in the world and was the highest grossing tours of the day. Now, granted, in the 80s, the game changed entirely and concerts went from selling in the millions to the tens and hundreds of millions. And nowadays, U2 has the highest record selling concert of all time at about $830 million. That's right, short of a billion. But let me set the picture for you here. On March 28th, 1973, they had just dropped Houses of the Holy, which was coming off a string of hit albums. Zeppelin 2, Zeppelin 3, Zeppelin 4, the greatest singular rock album of all time. And like always, they gotta do the tour to get out there, rock out the fans, get the word out, all that good stuff. But they could not have anticipated what happened on March 4th, 1973. They land in Georgia, head to Braves Stadium, and there's 40,000 fans waiting to meet them. The next night, they play Tampa Stadium, 56,000, almost 57,000 fans show up. It was pretty soon that they were breaking records nightly, including the record for the Beatles' largest concert in U.S. history at Shea Stadium. They knocked that one out of the park, and this allowed them to scale out a concert like nobody had ever seen before. They started getting out dry ice, lasers, mirrors, mirror balls, Catherine wheel pyrotechnics, double guitars, double theremins, blistering solos. This also was so successful that they were able to buy the Zeppelin Starship, which was a passenger jet that they just hollowed out so that the band could live in, practice in, and generally party it up in. And if we were to tell all the debaucherous stories of what happened on that plane, we'd have to do a whole nother legacy of rock. But let's face it, when you're doing 3-hour sets every night to the point where the only space in your mind is filled with instruments and music, you need a place to just breathe for a minute. Also, that plane was great to have because they originally had a small Falcon jet, which was susceptible to air turbulence, which, knowing the history of rock stars and planes, I think we would just like to have the safest plane possible. You can just see the intensity of this tour when you watch the filming of Madison Square Garden sets, which is now called The Songs Remain the Same. And that's especially a dedicated night because that same day, $203,000 of the group's money had been stolen from a safe deposit box at the Drake Hotel. The culprit's never been found. Anybody who can be hyped after losing that kind of money, I respect them. To sum it all up though, Led Zeppelin changed the game because they made the stadium tour a viable thing. Soon Elton John became the highest grossing tour artist of all time. Then it was U2, then it was Pink Floyd, and then it was Ed Sheeran, which is the most recent addition at over $700 million. Y'all can say hate him if you want, but how's that dude making bank? But it all started with Led Zeppelin charging $6.50 for a ticket and making it back in droves. Now, here's a cool fact here. This tune was the song that started it all. May 4th, 1973 at Braves Stadium. This is rock and roll. People throughout history have been judged for their biggest blunder, and that's all anybody will ever remember them for. I mean, think about it. Napoleon invading Russia in the winter. NASA taping over the original shots of the moon landing. Somebody got fired for that and created the moon landing conspiracy. But most of all, perhaps one of the biggest rock and roll blunders, no, nay, the biggest, is Dick Rowe and his blunder, which, as we know, any rock fan will tell you, is not signing the Beatles. Even going so far as to tell the Beatles manager Brian Epstein, sorry man, guitar groups are on the way out, we're going in a different direction. But despite we only knowing Dick Rowe's name for that little chestnut, he should also be known for totally redeeming himself a few weeks later on May 5th, 1963, when he signed the Rolling Stones at the behest, get this, of George Harrison. So the story goes that on April 14th, Rowe rejects the Beatles, but Please Please Me ends up going to like number one right after. Big, big blunder. But they're at a talent show together where they're judges on a panel, George Harrison and Dick Rowe. And perhaps as a friendly piece of advice, but more than likely as a chirp, I'll bet ya, George Harrison leans over to Dick Rowe and says, "Hey man, I just saw this new group. They're called the Rolling Stones. You should go see them. I think you should sign them. Don't miss out on them like you missed out on us." So after that talent show, the Stones are playing a Sunday night residency at the Station Hotel. Dick went down there, saw them play, not to make a mistake, signed them on the spot. From there, they ended up getting met up with their management company. The management company takes them out clothes shopping and all that, and eventually designs the image that we know as sort of the bad boys of rock and roll, comparable to, at the time, the cleaner cut Beatles. I mean, perspective-wise, of course, there were some people who just thought rock and roll was the devil entirely. But I think that this puts to bed the theory that the Beatles and the Stones were rivals. It's long been discussed, but if you think about it, without George Harrison, the Stones might never have been signed to Decca Records. Or maybe Dick Rowe might have gone and seen them and made another blunder, like signing the Tremonals over the Beatles. And the whole Stones catalog timeline might be different. Insane to think about this domino effect here. That's bigger than what Napoleon did or whatever. And now it's time for a song we might not have had without George Harrison, Dick Rowe, having faith in the Stones. How about a little Paint It Black? A lot of members of the Liner Note Leftovers crowd, yourself included, might remember how different it was buying concert tickets back in the day. Ticketmaster didn't have its stranglehold on where you could buy tickets. Scalpers didn't have bots that could ping off about 15 different countries to scam you out of Tragically Hip tickets that one time. They got lucky I got them or I would have raised hell. This was a serious thing, especially in the grunge scene. For example, here's Kurt Cobain finding out about concert ticket prices in 93.
First question is, what do you think of artists who do charge anywhere between $50 to $75 for tickets?
There are people
who charges
charge
that much money?
Who does that?
And to add a little Chris Novoselic.
Yeah. We were talking about, boy, we should charge $25 and really milk it.
Adorable, considering ticket prices these days. But one band that tried to fight the good fight better than any was, of course, Pearl Jam. And they had good reason to be pissed, because they found out that Ticketmaster was not only charging an extra surcharge on their tickets, but also was paying venues to use Ticketmaster as their exclusive means of buying them. This was a huge thing back in the day. I know it's common knowledge now, but nobody knew that then. And Pearl Jam was pissed because they thought their tickets were $20 a pop, $18 plus a $180 surcharge. So after trying to go ahead with the tour and only book at venues that didn't use Ticketmaster, they realized that is nothing short of impossible, and on May 6, 1994, file an official complaint with the Justice Department requiring the band to testify before Congress in a monopoly hearing. Now, of course, Ticketmaster's CEO at the time probably did not help the situation by saying, if Pearl Jam wants to play for free, we'd happily distribute their tickets for free. And this lawsuit went on and on and on. It was especially awkward when Pearl Jam introduced Neil Young into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and some total genius decided to put Ticketmaster's table right next to Pearl Jam's. Luckily, it ended in some brevity and not a food fight like Eddie Vedder predicted. But eventually, Pearl Jam just had to let it go. The federal investigation was dropped. In 1995, they start hitting the Vitalogy tour. And by then, Ticketmaster had spread its claws even further, forcing Pearl Jam to work with them. And they've just gotten bigger since. As we know, they merged with Live Nation in 2010. So it's pretty much the only place to buy tickets right now. Pearl Jam knows it. They've kind of been working with them in the last few years to keep down on scalpers and outrageous ticket prices and inflation and that kind of thing. There's of course been limited success, but tell me that when you look at the price of Metallica tickets nowadays. Do yourself a favor. Unless you can afford it, don't do it. You gotta really respect them for doing their best and trying hard though. For that brief little time, Pearl Jam, they were the Dissidents. There's been no shortage of petty moments in rock history, and a lot of them, more than we can count, have been spurned on by critics versus bands. But you gotta be careful as a critic what you say, otherwise you might be invited to be part of a baseball game. Dun dun dun! Okay, I'm being a little bit silly here, but it did actually happen that way. May 6th, 1978. Now, it's kind of a weird story, so follow me on this. Rolling Stone had kind of a weird relationship with the Eagles, in that they had been admittedly a bit harsh towards the band for every single album, even leading up to Hotel California itself, which dropped in 77. Like, seriously, go read Robert Christgau's review of Eagles albums. But that's not what ticked them off, or at least it wasn't the straw that broke the camel's back. What actually set this whole weird baseball game off was Charles M. Young, who wrote the gossip column for Rolling Stone, which was called Random Notes. So he writes a column and says, hey, look at the Eagles, man. They played softball games against a radio station and Jimmy Buffett, and they lost. Losers. Don Henley did not take a liking to this, so he writes a letter back, basically telling Young to, so to speak. And this back and forth goes on publicly through several issues of Rolling Stone over the next, year. The Eagles, who are on vacation, seem to be more interested in finding a softball team they can beat than a music to play. And this is directly from the article. Having lost in recent weeks to teams fielded by Andrew Gold, Jimmy Buffett, employees of several San Francisco radio stations, and their own road crew. So it finally comes to a head that either Don Henley or Glenn Frey, depending on who you ask, says, put your money where your mouth is. In fact, in the letter, here's what was said. What you have failed to mention is that the Eagles won 2 out of 3 games against Jimmy Buffett. Anytime you pencil-pushing desk jockeys want to put on your spikes, we'll kick your ass too. Rolling Stone, not to be outdone, nut up or shut up, flies all the way to Los Angeles to play baseball with the Eagles. Now, there was also $5,000 towards UNICEF put on the line, but the bragging rights were huge as well. So the Rolling Stone team consists of Charles M. Young, writers like Cameron Crowe, Ben Fong-Torres, and Joe Klein, dubbing themselves the Gonzos after the legendary Hunter S. Thompson, who did not play baseball, even though I feel like he would if they asked. And all that mouthing off came to a head with the Eagles actually trouncing Rolling Stone magazine in this baseball game. 15-8. Not bad for all 5 members of the Eagles and some roadies. Now, there was peace made, especially after a night of eating and drinking together after the game, but not without a passing barb. Don Henley and Glenn Frey wrote in Rolling Stone a little bit later, quote, in the end, it was the errors that cost Rolling Stone the game. The first error was to call the Eagles sissies. Sissies they were not. And if you ever need a good relief pitcher, Don Henley might be your man. Also, one more quick fact. Instead of the national anthem at that game, when everybody all rise, somebody happened to replace it with Life in the Fast Lane. Apparently, the crowd, along with future California Governor Jerry Brown, found this hilarious. So if the states ever need a new national anthem, just maybe, just a suggestion.
See,
I told you this would be all about the external weird parts of rock and roll. And that they were. You now know more than most people know about Robert Palmer's Addicted to Love. So bring that up in conversation with your favorite vinyl nerd. If they're not too busy waxing poetic whether or not that sounds better on 180 gram vinyl or standard. Hopefully you know a little bit more about Dick Rowe now and don't judge him for that one, albeit earth-changing mistake that he made. And if you ever need some guys to round out a squad out on the baseball diamond, the Eagles are your guys. Hey, before we get out of here, if you ever want to share in the rock and roll knowledge, remember, you can always hit me up with your favorite liner note leftover of your own. My email is danielmsoul@gmail.com, or you can hit up 1061 The Goat on your favorite social media platform. Leave us a review on your favorite podcast service. That helps the show out a ton. Now, as always, I'll leave you with a piece of advice. Always grab life and your vinyl by the edges.
That's a wrap on this week's episode. For more musical discoveries with Dan Soul, head to MyLloydMinsterNow.com or subscribe to Liner Note Leftovers wherever you get your podcast fix.